From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on what's happening in Ukraine following Crimea's annexation, big vote coming up this weekend in Afghanistan, averting a famine in South Sudan, plus the White House says Cuban Twitter was not a covert operation. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Ukrainian officials have alleged that the mass killings of protesters in Kiev in February took place on the orders of ousted President Viktor Yanukovych and that Russian security service agents helped him plan and carry out the assault. Acting Interior Minister Arsen Avakov told reporters in Kiev on Thursday that Mr. Yanukovych issued the criminal order to open fire against protesters on February 18th through 20th. Speaking at the same news conference, the head of Ukraine's security service said that there were grounds to believe that agents of Russia's Federal Security Service, or FSB, were involved in the planning and implementation of the so-called anti-terrorist operation in the Ukrainian capital in late February. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov responded to Ukraine's accusation on Saturday, saying that he doesn't want to judge how accurate Ukraine's information is without more true information. He spoke following a meeting of foreign ministers from member states of the Collective Security Treaty Organization, a regional military alliance comprising Russia and five other post-Soviet era states, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan.
ОДКБ не заинтересовано.
NATO this week indicated it was diminishing its relationship with Russia over Moscow's annexation of Crimea. He noted Thursday at the CSTO meeting that the group is not interested in escalating tensions with anyone, including NATO. Now some analysis of NATO's decision this week regarding Russia and its commitment to collective defense following the annexation of Crimea. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshra looking at Ukraine's relationship with NATO.
NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen used strong language to describe Russia's military incursion into Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea.
Russia's aggression against Ukraine is the gravest threat to European security in a generation.
That view is shared by Georgetown University NATO expert Charles Kupchin.
There have been other competitors for that honor, including the Russian invasion of Georgia in 2008. But I think this represents the most serious development in that Mr. Putin has broken the rules. He has done so in a way that threatens a rules-based international system.
Kupchin says for the first time since the collapse of the Berlin Wall, NATO is thinking about increasing its ability to defend the territorial integrity of its member states.
We've seen F-15s, F-16s, and AWACS deployed in Central Europe. And so in that respect, we are witnessing what could be the return of militarized rivalry between Russia and the West. We're not there yet, but if Putin doesn't hold off, we will be headed in that direction.
NATO's 28 members are committed to the notion of collective defense. In other words, an attack on one member is an attack on all of them. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, 12 countries from Eastern and Central Europe have become NATO members. Charles Kupchin says President George W. Bush favored NATO membership for two other states.
In 2008, there was a discussion about the possibility of putting Ukraine on a path to NATO membership along with Georgia. Washington was pushing that agenda. There was considerable resistance coming from Europe. And I think it's safe to say that the prospect of Ukraine joining NATO is on ice for now, maybe on ice permanently. We don't know.
Ohio Wesleyan University NATO expert Sean Kay says public opinion surveys in Ukraine in 2008 indicated only about 30% of the population favored NATO membership.
So we were really pushing something that the Ukrainians didn't want, the Russians said was clearly going to be a problem. And for some reason, we pushed that. And ironically, it made it more difficult to get Russian help on Iran. You know, what did we gain out of that? Virtually nothing. And I think history is going to treat that 2008 NATO declaration rather poorly.
That declaration simply stated NATO leaders agreed Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, but no time frame was given. Sean Kay says Russian President Putin has been consistently against Ukraine's NATO membership.
Because from his point of view, he has used the role of NATO as a way to rally this Russian sentiment of defeat and humiliation, and therefore they have to do bold things to be respected. And in fact, that's actually counterproductive to Russians' own interests.
Analysts point to Russia's annexation of Crimea as a bold thing. Experts wonder whether President Putin has other bold things in mind. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
And before we conclude our reporting on Ukraine, we look at the special police units blamed for those deadly shootings in Kyiv in February. Here's VOA's Al Pessin.
Ukraine has several special police forces, including the Security Service and the Berkut Riot Police, both of which have been implicated in the Kyiv shootings. Senior fellow Igor Sudyagin at London's Royal United Services Institute says he's not surprised that such forces have been mentioned and that several Berkut officers have been arrested. But he says early indications that most of the shooters were from Berkut are probably not accurate.
I have some doubts whether it was exclusively Berkut and whether it was mainly Berkut, because the radio communications intercepts shows that there were security services snipers participating in that, while they were not alone. So there might be Berkut snipers as well.
Sutyagin says the Berkut forces were mainly on the streets, while the security police were deployed to the upper floors of buildings around the main protest site in Maidan Square and along Institutska Street. Most of those killed were reportedly hit with bullets fired from above. The Berkut force was created in 1988, just 3 years before the Soviet Union fell. Independent Ukraine kept the force ostensibly as riot police, but Sutyagin says it became something else, in part because it answered to senior interior ministry officials rather than police commanders.
They were somehow sort of Praetorian guards for Ministry of Interior and maybe even for politicians, and they obeyed their orders. And so it's not about mainly not about Berkut itself, it's about orders which were issued for them to obey.
He says it makes sense that the Berkut and other well-disciplined top-level forces operated under orders from senior officials on that bloody February day, as the government has charged. But Sudyagin also says that after 2 months on the freezing cold streets of Kyiv, the police officers were openly hostile toward the protesters, who also hated them. He says that contributed to the violence that killed more than 100 people, mostly protesters, and brought down a government. The interim Ukrainian government's report implicates ousted President Viktor Yanukovych and says Russian security service agents helped him plan and carry out the assault in mid-February. Mr. Yanukovych rejects the allegations. The Russian government has denied any involvement in the violence and blamed the deaths on the protesters. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Afghan voters head to the polls on Saturday, choosing a new president, what U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry calls a pivotal moment, a historic vote, and could mark Afghanistan's first democratic transition of power. As U.S. and NATO forces prepare to end their combat role at year's end, Mr. Kerry called this Afghanistan's moment, referring to the election process as Afghan-owned from the start. RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank tells VOA's Victor Beatty Afghan voters will be choosing the first post-American leadership for their country since U.S. forces first entered the country in October of 2001 following the al-Qaeda terrorist attacks the preceding September.
Hamid Karzai was the president throughout the period when the United States and the world community was providing security assistance, troops, and an enormous amount of money. That all is going to be changing starting this year. So this election will choose the leadership for Afghanistan as a nation standing on its own, because this is an Afghan election being run by Afghans for Afghans. So foreign parties really should be standing on the sidelines. They should be watching very closely, but ultimately it's Afghans who will live with the result and therefore Afghans who should run it. It's sometimes been said that the most important hallmark of a democracy is not the first election, but the second. For Afghanistan, that could well prove true. The first election sometimes is watched by the world community and facilitated by the world community, but a transition from one democratically elected government to the next is an important hallmark in a maturing democracy. That doesn't mean that things will be perfect on Saturday. They were not perfect in Afghanistan's first election in 2009. A flawed election is much, much better than no election at all. And I think we have every reason to hope that this election will be a step forward.
I've heard it said that Afghanistan is ungovernable. The British found that out. The United States seemed to find that lesson out. Is an Afghan leader capable of governing that entire country?
Well, the Soviets found that out, too. So perhaps the lesson is Afghanistan is ungovernable by a foreign power. What is less clear is whether Afghanistan is ungovernable by an Afghan leadership that genuinely represents its own people.
Why is what happens in Afghanistan important to its neighbors?
Well, from Pakistan's standpoint, the border between Afghanistan and its own territories is always unsettled. Afghanistan does not even recognize the Durand line, the line that Pakistan considers to be its border, as a legitimate international division. From Afghanistan's standpoint, there is no agreed-upon border between itself and Pakistan. So naturally, Pakistan is concerned about this. Pakistan also sees Afghanistan traditionally as what it considers to be its source of strategic depth in its contest with India. The population of Afghanistan is a plurality Pashtun, and the Pashtun population spills over into Pakistan. By most reckoning, there are more Pashtun in Pakistan than in Afghanistan. And this is a group that does not really place a whole lot of stock in international borders. So from Pakistan's standpoint, it's not even possible to simply shut the door on Afghanistan and forget about it. From Iran's standpoint, there are similar issues. There are Baluch who spill across the border and some other smaller ethnic groups. There also are a lot of Shia in Afghanistan, most of them Hazaras. And Iran has engaged in proxy battles on behalf of its co-religionists in Afghanistan, and a lot of that has spilled across borders. Russia, of course, is interested because of its historical ties and because of the trade connections. Same goes for Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and other neighbors. India is interested largely because of the dynamic with Pakistan.
RAND Corporation South Asia analyst Jonah Blank speaking with my colleague Victor Beatty. United Nations warns millions of people in South Sudan are facing a potential famine because of a huge funding shortfall. About 1 million South Sudanese have been forced to flee their homes during the past 100 days. More than 800,000 are internally displaced within South Sudan. The rest are refugees in neighboring countries. UN Humanitarian Coordinator in South Sudan, Toby Lanzer, says people are facing destitution.
We've got 3.7 million people who are already at severe risk of starvation. And we are, in the month of April and May, supposed to be celebrating the planting season. This is when it starts to rain and when people cultivate their fields, they tend to their cattle, their sheep, and their goats, but they can't because it's unsafe. They can't move to their fields with the sort of freedom that is required.
Lanzer is telling international donors and government officials that millions of South Sudanese need help to survive. But he also says these people must be given the opportunity to help themselves. He says money is needed now to make sure that people have food in their stomachs so that they can have the energy to farm the land. He tells VOA it is critical that farmers be given the seeds and tools they need to start planting their crops today.
If we were to miss the planting season, there will be a catastrophic decline in food security, because what will strike that country, and it will hit about 7 million people, will be more grave than anything that continent has seen since the mid-1980s. So we're trying to prevent that. And if that were to happen, it's going to cost people a whole lot more. So invest now or pay later.
Lanzer says an immediate injection of $232 million would enable agencies to pre-position relief supplies before the rainy season, which will render most of the country inaccessible by road. African and European Union leaders wrapped up a two-day summit aimed at improving trade ties, but the talks in Brussels were overshadowed by the worsening crisis in the Central African Republic. Henry Ridgewell reports now from London.
Over the past 10 days, UN officials say more than 60 people have been killed in sectarian violence in the Central African Republic capital, Bangui. Recent violence there and in other CAR cities has prompted tens of thousands of Muslims to flee their communities. The European Union announced Wednesday it would deploy more troops alongside the 2,000 French soldiers and 6,000 African peacekeepers already in the country. But on Thursday, Chad said it is pulling its 850 peacekeepers out of the country, following accusations that the troops have sided with Muslims and Muslim rebels being attacked by the largely Christian anti-Balaka militia. Interim President of Central African Republic, Catherine Samba-Panza, welcomed the EU reinforcements.
Tout en menant cette opération de sécurisation du pays,
she said throughout the military operation, the process of reconciliation must be strengthened. So the presence of the military force has no effect on the process of reconciliation. On the contrary, she added, this process will be stronger under improved security. The new deployment was agreed upon after several EU members offered last-minute financial and logistical help, says Alex Vines, the Africa programme head of the London-based policy institute Chatham House.
It's the right thing, but it shows the difficulties because European politicians are thinking, well, what's the exit strategy? How short can they be there?
As well as security, trade topped the summit agenda. Many African countries brought large business delegations. EU Council President Herman Van Rompuy praised the changing relationship between Europe and Africa.
More than 800 business and economic leaders committed to improve the business climate and foster investment in African countries. A fundamental shift from aid to trade and investment as agents of growth and poverty reduction is taking place.
Moving from aid-based relationships to trade will require strong oversight, says ActionAid Zambia Director Pamela Chisanga.
If this trade is largely going to benefit the large multinational corporations who find their way into Africa, then obviously that is a problem. While we look forward to increased trade, it must be fair trade.
Africa's economic growth is second only to Asia. European leaders say that rapid development requires an overhaul of the paternalistic relationships of the past. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
News is mobile and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
An Associated Press report says the U.S. government secretly financed a social network in Cuba in an effort to stir political unrest and undermine the country's communist government. The network, known as Zunzuneo, reportedly drew tens of thousands of subscribers who were unaware it was backed by the U.S. government. Former Zunzuneo user Ernesto Guerra remembers being impressed with the network.
That
it was a very noble service. You would log on and you could write 140 characters and hit send. He said it was free of charge. Associated Press reports the U.S. Agency for International Development project lasted more than 2 years. The program evaded Cuba's internet restrictions by creating a so-called Cuban Twitter text messaging service that could be used to organize political demonstrations. The AP report says the project was created with secret shell companies and financed through foreign banks. On Thursday, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said the so-called Cuban Twitter was a development program, not a covert operation. AP says details uncovered by its reports appear to contradict the USAID's longstanding claim that it does not conduct covert actions. Cuban government declined an AP request for comment. The soldier who killed three people before committing suicide in an attack on the same U.S. military base where more than a dozen people were killed in 2009 had shown no recent risk of violence. The gunman, identified as Ivan Lopez by Texas Representative Michael McCaul, chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee, opened fire at Fort Hood in the U.S. state of Texas on Wednesday afternoon. The U.S. Army's top civilian official, John McHugh, said the soldier saw no combat during a four-month deployment to Iraq as a truck driver from August to December of 2011.
He was seen just last month by a psychiatrist. He was fully examined. And as of this morning, we had no indication on the record of that examination that there was any sign of likely violence, either to himself or to others, no suicidal ideation.
And Secretary of the Army McHugh said Lopez's record showed no indication of being part of an extremist group.
The background checks we've done thus far show no involvement with extremist organizations of any kind, but as General Milley said to me last evening, and I know the Chief and I fully support, we're not making any assumptions by that. We're going to keep an open mind and an open investigation, and we will go where the facts lead us. And possible extremist involvement is still being looked at very, very carefully.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney spoke about the shootings at his Thursday news briefing.
The President and First Lady's thoughts and prayers go out to the families and friends of the killed and wounded individuals. We commend the military personnel, the first responders and the medical staff who responded swiftly to the horrific shooting. The President directed his team to utilize every resource available to fully investigate the shooting.
Investigators are searching for answers in the Wednesday shooting that killed three people and wounded 16 others.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
And a couple of stories from the world of science. U.S. Space Agency NASA plans to send humans to an asteroid and Mars eventually. But a group of prominent U.S. scientists say right now any deep space mission will be too dangerous based on NASA's minimum safety requirements and engineering capabilities and understanding of the effects of long-term cosmic radiation exposure will not advance sufficiently, they say, within the next 5 years to change that assessment. Researchers at the University of California, Davis, say they have solved the riddle of how the zebra got its stripes. The theory of evolution states animals develop patterns on their bodies if it gives them a survival advantage. But according to a new study, zebras develop the stripes to avoid annoying and sometimes dangerous bites from insects. Scientists have known for a long time that certain insects prefer to bite animals who are all white or all black rather than striped ones. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Good to have you with us today. A reminder, you can always find us on the internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Keith Holmes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On April 4th, 1818, Congress ordered that the U.S. flag be redesigned, reducing the number of stripes to the original 13 and setting the number of stars at 20. It also ordered that on admission of every new state into the Union, one star should be added. In 1905, an earthquake in India's Kangra Valley killed 20,000 people. In 1968, America's leading black civil rights leader, Martin Luther King Jr., was shot to death at a hotel in Memphis, Tennessee. 2 months after the shooting, escaped fugitive James Earl Ray was arrested in England. He pleaded guilty and was sentenced to 99 years in prison. On this day in 1986, Martin Luther King Day was established as a national holiday in the United States. On this day in 1964, the Beatles broke a record by having songs in all of the top five positions on the Billboard Hot 100 pop music chart at the same time. In 1969, American heart surgeon Dr. Denton Cooley implanted the first artificial heart in a human patient. In 1973, the World Trade Center in New York was officially dedicated. Its famous twin towers were destroyed in the 2001 terrorist attacks on the United States. But with a new design, the Trade Center has since been rebuilt. In 1976, Prince Norodom Sihanouk was forced by the Khmer Rouge to resign as the symbolic leader of Cambodia. 13 years later, after Vietnam overthrew the Khmer Rouge, negotiations with the Vietnamese installed government decided that Sihanouk should return to Cambodia as its king. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry marked NATO's 65th anniversary at a time when some of the basic principles underlying the international system have been violated. NATO, Mr. Kerry affirmed, remains unified and strong. The alliance is maintaining political dialogue with Russia, but has suspended all NATO-Russia cooperation. It is providing reassurance to all member states that Article 5, the mutual defense clause at the core of NATO, means what it says. The United States has already made contributions to bolstering deterrence and reassurance, demonstrating its unwavering commitment to Article 5. In recent weeks, the U.S. has augmented NATO's Baltic air policing mission with 6 additional F-15s and deployed 12 F-16s to Poland. The USS Truxtun has carried out exercises in the Black Sea, with another U.S. ship to go to the Black Sea soon. Europe and North America remain united behind Ukraine's right to determine its future, and they reject Russia's annexation of Crimea. Russia needs to withdraw its military forces from Ukraine's border and begin negotiations with Ukraine's government. In order to support Ukraine economically during this crisis, NATO allies have pledged their support, and the United States is working with the International Monetary Fund to implement an assistance package in return for political and economic reforms. Russian natural gas giant Gazprom recently announced a significant increase in the price of natural gas it supplies to Ukraine. Secretary Kerry condemned the price hike, saying no nation should use energy to stymie a people's aspirations. We can't allow it to be used as a political weapon or an instrument for aggression. The U.S. is working with Ukraine and our allies on its western borders to prepare to reverse natural gas flows in some of their pipelines so that Ukraine can access additional gas supplies if needed. The United States is proud to be providing Ukraine emergency finance and technical assistance in the area of energy security, energy efficiency, and energy sector reform. As free nations, the United States and its NATO allies will continue to stand together in defense of international law, mutual security, and rights of nations like Ukraine to freely choose their own destiny.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.